It was 10 years ago that Dave came home from a visit to Cape Breton with his uncle Jimmy's electric razor. Didn't steal the razor. His aunt Elizabeth, Jimmy's wife, Jimmy's widow, gave the razor to Dave. Elizabeth, who's 87 years old, lives alone in Halifax in a rambling wooden house a stone's throw from the university. Elizabeth, who Dave tries to visit every time he's through town, has been parceling out Jimmy's possessions to relatives for 25 years. On previous and trips subsequent to the electric razor, Dave has walked out of Elizabeth's with a wooden-handled hairbrush, a wool jacket, a thick black and gold ballpoint pen, and a stuffed duck. "This used to be your uncle's duck," Elizabeth said as she handed it to him, Dave standing there at her door, holding on to his suitcase. What could he say except thank you? What else could he do except march up to airport security with a duck tucked under his arm? They x-rayed it. "Seems to be dead," said the security guard as he handed it back. So each time Elizabeth handed him something, Dave thanked her earnestly and dutifully lugged it home, which is why he has a stuffed duck on the shelf in his bedroom closet. That's where he put the hairbrush and the electric razor, too, on the shelf in his closet, out of the main current, but not out of the river of his life. Elizabeth is the last sister alive, and visiting Elizabeth is one way Dave can still visit his father, one way he can still reach out to Charlie. Elizabeth's children, Dave's cousins, have been trying to get her out of her house and into a home for almost a decade, ever since she began boiling all the tap water before she'd use it. Elizabeth began doing this a year or so before her 80th birthday. At first, she just boiled drinking water, but now she boils everything. She boils the water she's going to cook in before she boils it for cooking. Boils her bath water. She has 2 power bars in her bedroom and 8 electric kettles in a row. Takes her an hour to fill the tub. "It's poison," she said, "but you can boil the poison out if and you're careful." Aside from her thing with the water, Elizabeth seems eminently capable of caring for herself. And her dramatic good health has given Dave pause about her water boiling. Anyway, the razor. The razor spent 5 years squirreled away at the top of Dave's bedroom closet in its zippered leather case, and then one Saturday afternoon when Dave was home alone and doing nothing of consequence, he went looking for a sweater and he found the razor instead. Dave plugged the razor in, and to his great surprise, it worked. And in that instant, that vibrating piece of antique chrome became his razor. And in that instant, Dave knew that Uncle Jimmy's razor would imbue the morning ritual of shaving with a new pleasure, the pleasure of continuity, the pleasure of touching the past. Things are seldom that simple. The first morning, Sunday, was simple. But the second morning, the Monday morning, the razor's motor cut out abruptly, halfway through the job. Dave staring in the bathroom window with his Uncle Jimmy's razor clinging to his beard like a leech. Now, the last thing you want to do if you have an electric razor sucking on your beard is to try and pull it off. No telling what might happen. You have to be clever about these things. Well, first you have to take a moment to panic. You imagine yourself hunching into the nearest emergency room, the razor dangling from your face, and some smart-assed intern grabbing a hold of it and grinning, saying something like, "This might hurt a bit." So you don't go to the hospital. You work at it yourself, and after Dave had fiddled with it for a few moments, he got the razor back to life by twisting the electric cord, holding it at a certain angle. Nothing to it. As long as he held the cord in that position, the razor worked fine. And so, shaving became a two-handed job. One hand to hold the razor, the other to twist the cord, and as long as he got the angle right, the razor behaved. And this worked fine for a couple of years, but all the twisting and turning eventually took its toll on the electric cord, and the razor got crankier and crankier. And one morning, Dave finally got fed up. This is ridiculous, he thought. And he headed off to the basement with Uncle Jimmy's razor, determined to fix it. There are many satisfactions in this beautiful life. But one of the great satisfactions up there with great meals and great friendships and afternoon naps is fixing something that's broken. The devil himself could bump down the basement stairs when a man is engrossed in, say, fixing an electric razor. And the devil could scratch a match on a wooden beam and smile and say, "Excuse me, don't mean to startle you, sir. But I thought you'd like to know that upstairs in your living room there is a woman waiting, and she is waiting on you. And all your secret desires and wishes, and I know them all, sir. They're all there in this woman. You might say she's the woman of your dreams, and if you just put that screwdriver down and follow me up those stairs, surely you'd like to make her acquaintance, sir. There could be no harm in that, surely. And I'm sure you would like to meet her, for she is part Haley Mills from the original Parent Trap. And she's part Audrey Hepburn from Wait Until Dark. But she is also part Lisa Bonet from that movie that was censored, and I don't think you've seen the uncut version of that film, have you, sir? The part with the chicken blood? Well, that's the part that is playing upstairs right now in your living room, sir, right now. And your family won't be home for hours. The devil could puff on his cigarette and say all of that, and oh yes, some men would go. Even some family men would go. But not if they were fixing something. If they were fixing something, you know what they would do. They'd wave their screwdriver absentmindedly in the air and they'd say, I'll be up in a minute. I'm just about done here. But they wouldn't be up in a minute. Because you're never just about done when you're fixing something. Dave took the back off the electric razor. The simplicity of it is what startled him. Everything was so small, Dave wasn't sure how he was supposed to repair it. He found a loose connection. He tried to glue it back into place, but that proved unsatisfactory. And he was worried about electrical arcing, so he covered the join with electrical tape, and he plugged the razor in, and it didn't work at all. And he thought, well, there's nothing to lose, so he got out his soldering gun and he resoldered every connection he could see. And then he replaced the electric cord with one he'd cut off an old tube radio, and he soldered that, and then he covered all the joins with more tape, and by the time he had finished, there was so much solder and so much electrical tape, he couldn't get the chrome cover back on. But the razor was working. So he got a roll of duct tape out, and he wrapped it around in duct tape, and he was back in business. It wasn't as elegant as it had once been, but it was functional. And it was Uncle Jimmy's. And he had fixed it himself, and that gave him a certain pleasure. And he still had the chrome case, and he intended to get it repaired one day when he could find someone to repair it, and he had the time to take it to them. And in the meantime, he was worried about dirt fouling the circuitry of the motor, so instead of the leather case, he kept it in a Ziploc plastic sandwich bag. Used it every morning. Even took it with him when he went away. He had it in his suitcase last month when he rushed out the door at 6:15 on a Friday morning. Horribly late for the 7:00 plane that he was supposed to be taking to New York City. Danny Kuchmar's daughter was getting married at noon. It'd be tight, but he could make it. If he made the plane, Danny used to play drums in the Flying Squirrels, a band that backed James Taylor, among others, and Dave and Danny went way back. As Dave squealed out of his driveway, his bag bounced on the seat beside him. He had a tie crammed in his pocket. He glanced at the clock on the dashboard, and he began to calculate what he had to do to make his plane. It would be tight. But if everything went without a hitch, he might make it. He would make it. He'd make it. He was going to make it. It's always like this with Dave in airports. Always. He's always late, habitually late. He never arrives an hour before a flight. Half an hour is too early for Dave. Those are airport rules. Dave doesn't play by airport rules. Those rules are for everyone else. Dave thinks he's better than airports. He thinks he can cheat time. He thinks he can outplay time, thinks he can get more out of time than time's going to give him. Airport time, anyway. Look at him. 6:15 in the morning, 45 minutes before an international flight, leaning forward over the wheel, squinting at the cars ahead of him, weaving in and out of traffic. He never drives like this. This is a gentle man. 45 minutes to go and he thinks he's okay. And what's he repeating over and over to himself? I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. Maybe he will. He's done it before. But this is Monday morning. Dave's not used to Monday morning driving. You know what's waiting for him around the corner. Traffic jam. Anyone else would have given up at this point. But Dave's not going to give up. He's not even going to stop. He's on the shoulder. He's leaving the highway and exit early. He's cutting through an industrial park. He has no idea where he's going. Streets aren't straight in there. They curve in long arcs that make you lose your sense of direction, and he's using the sun to navigate. He's working on straight instinct here. And when he screams into the airport parking garage, 15 minutes later, he leaves a trail of blue smoke hovering in the air behind him. He has 12 minutes until his flight is scheduled to leave. And he's still muttering, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. He's muttering, I'm going to make it. As he slams the car door closed behind him, he has to check in and clear customs and immigration and security. He has to make it to his gate, but if there are no more hitches, maybe he can still make it. And he's running for the terminal now, his tie half out of his pocket, his suitcase bumping against his leg. He's going to carry it on with him. Maybe he is going to make it. But when he bursts into the terminal, he comes in at the wrong end, the complete wrong end. This is the international terminal, and he doesn't know it well which way to go. Now, this is a moment for regrouping. Dave should stop for a moment, just for a brief moment. He should stop and check his ticket and check one of those departure screens. But the clock is ticking, and there's a 100-yard sprint ahead of him, and Dave figures he can read the screens on his way by them. And he's determined not to stop. He's sure he can do this on the fly. He has 10 minutes. And over again, he's repeating to himself, I'm going to make it, I'm going to make it. And with 8 minutes to go, he gets in the wrong line. He's in the first class line. And when he gets to the counter, the lady goes to wave him away, but then she sizes him up. He's sweating and disheveled, and she's begun to print him a ticket. And miracle of miracles, it stutters out of her machine in record time, and he grabs it, and he's running again, lurching toward the next stop, immigration, who wave him through with a nod and a smile, and he's home free. There are still 5 minutes to go, and he's still moving, still running. His shirt has pulled out now, and his heart is pounding, and he's really sweating, but he's going to make it, and that's when he hits security. It's always at the moment when you think victory is yours that things start going wrong. Dave clears the metal detector, and he's waiting for his suitcase to clear the X-ray machine, and so is the security guard. She asks him to open his suitcase, and he opens it and watches her reach inside and pull out his little Ziploc plastic bag. And she holds his razor in the air, swinging this ball of duct tape and dangling wires in front of his face. And she says, "What is this, sir?" It was the last thing he was thinking. Everything else seemed so much more important, to get so close and stumble on the last hurdle, to have to phone home and face Morley. I missed the plane, like she hadn't warned him. 100 times. Like she hadn't warned him this morning. He tried to get calm. He breathed deeply. And when he did, he noticed that everything around him had ground to a halt. The hustle and bustle of the security check had stopped, and everyone who had stopped was staring at him. He was surrounded by businessmen in business suits, men with sleek leather carry-on bags, men with cell phones, men with copies of the Wall Street Journal, men staring at his corduroy pants and his suede shoes and his untucked shirt tail, because they wanted to know the answer to the question as much as the security guard. Who is this guy? And what is this mass of tape and wires that she has found wrapped in his luggage? And Dave felt his heart sink. A man's razor is a reflection of his masculinity. A symbol of his manhood. Here he was surrounded by these stud horses, all of them whinnying and waiting on his explanation. And when he points at this ratty mess of wire and duct tape and says pathetically, "It's my razor," one of the men actually snorts. And Dave is engulfed by a wave of self-loathing. But he still has 4 minutes before his plane is scheduled to leave. And he's not about to give up. Not yet. He starts to explain about his Uncle Jimmy, and all the men are shaking their heads and walking away. And even the security guard isn't listening to him. She's saying, "You're going to have to turn it on for me, sir. You're going to have to shave for me." And Dave is no longer thinking about Morley or the businessman or even the security guard. All he can think about is his game plan, and his game plan is about to blow up in his face. It's fight or flight. Dave looks at the security guard and says, "I don't have time to turn it on. I don't want the razor. You keep the razor. It's yours." And he bolts. He grabs his suitcase and runs. And he's running as fast as he can all the way to his gate. And when he gets there, there are still 45 seconds left before his flight is scheduled to leave. But there's no one around. No one. It's completely empty. The sign behind the empty desk says New York. But there isn't a soul in sight. A departure gate has a certain funereal feel to it when it's devoid of passengers and animated clerks. Dave sensed there was something wrong. He ran to the lounge window and he saw his plane. It was still there at the gate. So he did something he knew he wasn't supposed to do. He went right through the crash doors and began to lurch along the corridor looking for the tunnel that would lead him to his flight. As the door swung shut behind him, they made a loud and ominous click. And Dave had a fleeting thought. "Whoops," he thought. "Maybe I shouldn't have done that." But there was nothing to do now but to keep going. So he followed the deserted corridor until he came against another locked door that wouldn't open. And only then, when there was nowhere left to turn, did he do what he should have done when he'd arrived at the airport. Because he couldn't think of anything else to do, Dave pulled out his ticket and he saw that his plane was scheduled to leave at 9 o'clock, not 7 o'clock. Should have felt like a fool. But he didn't. He felt happy. Because he was going to make it. And because he thought, "I can go back and get my razor." He turns back towards the plane and he realizes the only way out is to walk down the long, deserted hallway, through customs and back to where he started. The cavernous custom hall was deserted save for two uniformed clerks drinking coffee at a desk at the far end. And when Dave walked in, they both stared at him with complete amazement. It was 7 a.m. No international flights were scheduled to arrive for an hour. "Where did you come from?" they both asked. They were more understanding than you would have thought they'd be. They let him through with a minimum of fuss, although he did have to fill out a customs form. He declared a bottle of scotch and a carton of cigarettes. And he was vomited back into the terminal, at the wrong end again, of course. And he marched back through the airport, this time without stopping for a ticket. He went through immigration, being careful to avoid the clerk who had processed him not 15 minutes earlier. He went back to security. "Aren't you the guy with a razor?" said the guard, reaching for her walkie-talkie. "I changed my mind," said Dave. "I want it back." She made him turn it on. She made him run it over his face. He had hoped she'd let him do this in a little room somewhere out of sight. but they brought out a long extension cord, and he had to do it right there beside the X-ray machine. He said it felt like he was taking his pants down in public. But he was beyond embarrassment now. He got a coffee and a donut, and he went right to his gate, still an hour and a half before his flight. There was a clerk there now, but he was the first and only passenger. He sat down and he smiled at the clerk, and she smiled back at him. "You're early this morning," she said. He nodded calmly. "I always try to be," he said. Never understood those people who wait until the last moment. Thank you. Thank you. I'm Stuart McLean, and you're listening to The Vinyl Cafe on CBC Radio, heard every weekend at this time, Saturday mornings on Radio 2, Sundays at lunch on Radio 1.